to Malkia Talks, a Wheel of Time theory podcast. I am Rob, your host, and today, folks, we are getting into a very long anticipated episode. Some of you will know my guest today because of our show on Thursday nights at Threefold Talk, and some of you may know my guest today because basically a year ago, and in fact, by the time this episode comes out, it will be a year ago, we sat down and had a discussion about pacifism in the Wheel of Time. And so, of course, my guest today can only be Wise One, Shelley. How you doing, Shelley?
Hi. I am so happy to be back.
It is great to have you back. I mean, I see you every week for Threefold Talk, but, you know, we just checked.
It's nice to have one-on-one Rob time.
Yes. And it's been a year since we... Right now. It's been a year since we did the first recording together, which is mad. I can't believe it's been so long.
Well, and like I said, that's about as often as people need to hear me yammer about this stuff. So I'm happy to be back.
This is going to be a great episode, folks. You're in for, you know, like you're in for some learning, but some great learning. You're learning about Wheel of Time and real life stuff. It's going to be brilliant. So if you enjoyed the pacifism episode, you're going to love this. I'm certain of it. So, but yeah, we sat down and we did that. And about this time last year, it was like, we should get together and do this. And we've talked about it easily half a dozen times. And like you sent me the book, sent me the details of the book, and I got it, and it sat on my bench for like 3 months. And,
and you know, I was like, the best podcast guest, all assigned homework.
It's good homework, folks. Trust me. You know, I learned things doing this, but I was like, in the end, I said to Shelley, I was like, we need to pick a date to record because that'll actually give me a deadline, and then I'll read the book.
And then we push back three times.
Yeah. I pushed back because I got the wrong date, and then I can't remember what else happened. But yeah, we've rescheduled like three times to get this, but we're here and we're doing it and we're ready. And Shelley has a ream of notes, which are amazing, and we're going to have some fun with it. So
we can share those with your Patreons, maybe.
Oh yeah, that's a good idea. We should definitely share those out, folks. So you can see all the great stuff. I think I put in like, you know, the title, and I was like, Rob's poor attempt to sound brainy, and then I put nothing else in it. The rest is literally
Line. You put a really good line that gave me a lot of really cool ideas.
Okay. That's my role today, folks, is to facilitate great discussion, not necessarily put in great discussion myself. But yeah. So before we get going, we should probably clarify some terms, I suppose, that we're going to be using today, Shelley. And you're the expert.
I was going to say, I mean, the reason the pacifism episode brought this out is because when we were talking about pacifism, we were talking about how wars and battles are so, you know, critical to national identity. And, you know, a big part of that is nationalism. And so hopefully by the end of this episode, it'll be kind of clear the connection between pacifism and nationalism, or almost maybe the tension between the two. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it made me start thinking about nation building and what does a nation look like in the Wheel of Time, and how did Robert Jordan's context, you know, post-Vietnam War, writing during the Cold War, how did all that kind of bleed into his writing? Because there was a lot of nationalism going on at the time. So that's kind of what made me think about that when we were doing the pacifism episode. And then in terms of terms, so just a couple basic things that people can keep straight while we're talking about this is, when you talk about nationalism, there's a difference between the nation and the state. So the state is kind of more of like the government. So the structures and functions that make a nation run. But a nation doesn't necessarily have to have a state. And so the book that I suggested Rob read is called Imagined Community. And essentially it says a nation is a socially constructed community imagined by people who perceive to be themselves a part of that group. And what I always really liked about this definition is the idea of imagining. And that doesn't mean necessarily that it's made up. But when you think about your community and your nation, you're connected to thousands, millions of people who you've never met. And so, Rob, I'm sure you've experienced this when you meet, like, when you go traveling and you meet another Brit or you meet a New Zealander and you're like, hey, we have this connection. Even if your politics are totally different, even if you don't know each other, when you're out of your own context and meet someone else there, I have the same thing with Canadians when I travel. As soon as you meet a Canadian, you're like, yes, we are Canadian. Even if any other time we wouldn't be friends, we have this kind of imagined community around each other. And so I think some of that plays out in Wheel of Time. And to tie this back to kind of a Looney Theories podcast, you know, it kind of...
We're not always loonies here at, you know, Mackie Talks. Like, you know, we do the serious ones sometimes, and this is...
We do serious, but I think my theory that I would base this on for your theory podcast is that post-Wheel of Time, Manetherin, despite Elaine's best efforts, is going to become a nation and a state. I think that transition is inevitable. And I think part of the reason behind that is, A, this idea of an imagined community, and B, another theory of identity that I really like is by a philosopher called Paul Ricoeur, which is basically says that identity is built on the stories we tell about ourselves. And so, Rob, I'm sure you can think of the story I'm thinking of for Manetherin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, weep for Manetherin.
Absolutely, so yes.
They have these national stories that build up to an identity. And, you know, the ball has started rolling such that, you know, at the end we see Elaine trying to be like, well, you can have your own lord and you can have this and you can have that. But I think the nationalist impulse in Manetherin, in the Two Rivers, has probably risen past the point that Elaine is going to be able to bring that back under control. I think by this point, you know, they fought their own wars. They've had their own battles. They've had people immigrate. For a long time, they've had to be on their own without Andor's help. And they have, and now they've rediscovered these historical stories. So not only that, they do have a golden age kind of they can look back to, which is something that a lot of nationalist movements have, is a golden age they look back to. And so they've got all the, I guess, the pieces and the building blocks that I think, you know, if we return to Randland in 1,000 years, there would be an independent Two Rivers. Maybe it'll be called Manether again, maybe not, but it would be its own state. And I'm not saying that there wouldn't be a civil war with Andor for that to happen, but I think that's kind of my loony theory.
I like it.
And I just talked for a really long time.
No. It's fine. I mean, you're the expert on this stuff. So that's, you know, talking is kind of, you know, what I'm needing. But you've even got it in the notes. You've got a checklist of things they would need for it. So a fixed homeland, current or historical, check, obviously, mm-hmm. High autonomy, hostile surroundings, you put maybe. And I mm-hmm. suppose that, you know, their relation with Andor, I suppose, is what we're going for there.
Yep.
Memories of battles, definitely. Sacred centers, again, maybe. You know, site of the original city and things like that. Language and scripts.
And I can see where they did the battles of the Two Rivers.
True, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there would definitely be, I could see them raising some kind of monument to it or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe not, you know, a massive thing, but something. Languages and scripts, not so much, but special customs, most definitely, and historical records and thinking, check. So, you know, they've got a lot of things there that, you know, would be required mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, preconditions for the formation of a nation. So I like it.
Yeah. And even with the language, you know, I think Robert Jordan hints at that with Matt's ability to speak the Old Tongue fluently. But at least in the early books, you hear when they yell the Old Tongue without even thinking about it, everyone's like, I kind of understood what you said. And even in the show, I think we're starting, not that the show is canonical, but Nynaeve learns that. There's the Old Tongue is embedded in the culture there. In the other countries, it seems to be, at least in, you know, main Randland, not Seanchan, it seems to be a language that the nobles learn, but it's something that these people just kind of... inherently know. So yeah. Maybe language, maybe not. Who knows?
This is true. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, they know the occasional word, but they don't actually speak it in anywhere else you go. Like, oh, I think, does that word mean this or something? But as you say, it's just the nobles everywhere you go. And then you have the Two Rivers where people actually, you know, can kind of understand it. Or in the case of Matt, albeit he gets it through a really shitty manner. Basically can speak it fluently to the point where he doesn't even realize he's speaking it. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's quite a point of pride, I suppose they could have there. So, you know, I like it. I'm buying this, you know. Mm-hmm. I think people want it just when you finish reading the books, people kind of want it to be a nation of its own. They're like, it's earned the right to be that sort of thing. So it's, you know, it feels, in terms of how the story would flow, very natural that it would, you know, be the case, even if Perrin doesn't really want it to be the way. I don't know what would be in charge.
I think Perrin would be fine with it being a nation if he didn't have to be in charge of it.
But yes, that's actually probably more accurate. This is true.
And it's one of those things where, from the definition that you use of an imagined community, it is a nation in and of itself. It's just not really a state. You know, you could argue maybe that the Women's Circle and the Mayor's Council is kind of a state-like thing, but technically they're under the state of Andor. But they've never paid taxes. And there's a saying in nationalism studies that map is not territory. So just because you're on a map doesn't mean it's your territory. There are many other interpretations of that as well, but Andor says, oh, you know, they're on the map, and the Two Rivers is like, that's nice.
Mm. Doesn't mean we're yours. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So very true. Very, very true. So I do like it. I'm on board with this one completely. Even with the things that you know they don't have or maybes, you know, I don't think it matters. I think they've got enough there that it fits. So,
well, and I think if we want to build on those symbols, one really common symbol, and this probably spoke to Robert Jordan, is something called the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. A lot of countries have that particular monument, mm-hmm. and now we don't necessarily have that here, but I was thinking about King Aemon and Queen Eldrine. Like, we don't really know where their tombs are, but that story kind of fits as well. You know, the countless soldiers who died for Menetherin. So there is kind of that narrative and that mythology as well.
Yeah.
Feeding into that. So you can see some of the early representations of nation that Robert Jordan would have been familiar with kind of plugging into the stories that he's telling about Menetherin.
Yeah. Do you think he would have just been putting these in kind of subconsciously or deliberately?
It's so hard to tell with Robert Jordan, isn't it?
It is.
It's so, you can tell how so much of what he did in his life became embedded in his work. You can see things. And I think your brilliant idea was about the USSR. And how that's kind of like Sean Chan, and he would have been writing during, you know, the ends of the Cold War, and he would have been alive during the large part of the Cold War. Mm. And, you know, it was interesting because when I was researching into that, and I think about the Sean Chan and the comparison, and it's interesting that it made me think about the Tinkers and how the Tinkers go to the Sean Chan being like, this is a safe place. The people who live under the Sean Chan are kind of like, it's actually kind of the same as it was for us before, maybe a little better. Like there's no homelessness, you know, people are pulled off the streets to work. And that actually was done in the USSR. Like they basically did eliminate homelessness and everyone had a job. You know, when you look at it from a non-biased lens, there are good things that the USSR did. And I think Robert Jordan was trying to show that, like, I think he was smart enough to show that even though they were the great evil, they still had their areas where they were progressive that we weren't. And they had their areas where they were flawed that, you know, the West wasn't. And so I think that whole counterpoint of, you know, the other wasn't necessarily evil. I think is kind of what Robert Jordan was sometimes trying to add is the nuance, because he had the dark one, which is very obviously evil. But then you had this other nation that was different and had different ways of ruling the world. And they had slavery, which is terrible. But they had all these other things that were good that, you know, the Randland nations didn't necessarily have. So I don't think he was trying to say they were equal, but I think that might have been some of his, you know, his ability to see nuance in the world playing into his books.
Yeah, I agree. I literally had a discussion very similar to not nations, but the idea that, you know, it was a political discussion, mm-hmm. But the idea that, you know, someone may be considered a bad leader by some, or, you know, oh my God, I can't believe that person's in charge of the country. But that doesn't mean every single decision they make is bad.
Yeah.
You know, they might put policies and procedures in place. And actually, do you know what? Those are really great things. And they've improved the country mm-hmm. for a vast number of people, or, you know, the future going forwards, or, you know, or just fixed a problem that no one else could fix for some reason. You know, it very rarely is someone completely or a society completely just like the bad, you know, the dark one. You know, it's not a common thing. So Yeah, I think we can see that a lot in the Sean Chen. There's a lot of things you're like, they did do things right. Mm-hmm. You know, people, you know, no homelessness and such. And there's a very real world situation there with the USSR. So, but you did more of the, I didn't do many of that study. I put that idea and I was like, I need to study this. This sounds really good. And I did this, what, like 9 months ago now or something? Maybe not that long ago, but it was quite a long time ago. And then never went back to it. And then Shelley put in all the notes because Shelley's amazing. So,
well, and I'm sure we've just pissed off like half your audience who's just like, but I think we can handle nuance because we're grownups.
Exactly.
And I don't think any of us are excusing anything that was done during that period.
No.
And same as obviously both of us think slavery is bad. Which we shouldn't have to say that, but
yeah,
you know, let's be on record.
Yeah, I've been on record many times. I'm happy to say it again. Slavery is bad. You know, that is, you know. But it's not, it doesn't, you know, it's not a bad thing to say, hey, this mm-hmm. was a bad government or a bad, you know, bad society overall, or, you know, mm-hmm. anything of that sort of descriptor, and still say, but they did this bit right and they did that bit right. You know, that's a fine thing to say. There's nothing wrong with that, because that's recognizing that, you know, some people do things better than you, mm-hmm. you know, or the place you live, you know, the country you live in. So.
And I think the way it ties back into nationalism is within nationalism, there's usually an other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you other people, you remove that space for nuance. And so I think that's part of what's happening. You know, there's, you could almost argue at the end that Rand Land is kind of a nation in and of itself, just because they have fought against an other and they do have all the things. And this is the interesting thing about nations, is they can exist within nations. And we see this within Canada with, you know, Quebec nationalism. That was a thing really affected my growing up, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. Like, there was a very, you know, Quebec did a vote about whether or not they were going to leave Canada. And all the English speaking kids were like writing letters to Quebec saying, don't leave us. We love you. We love French. And, you know, there was terrorism in Canada. People were kidnapped and died. And people often don't know about this. But, you know, now the compromise under, I can't remember which prime minister said this, but they called Quebec a nation within a nation. And, you know, we start seeing this around the world with kind of embedded nationalisms as a way to keep different nations from separating from the state. So that is possibly an alternative. I don't know if any of the Elaine's descendants will come up with the nation within a nation rhetoric to keep Andor from separating. But it's an interesting idea, I think, just to be like, yeah, okay, so they are an independent identity under the umbrella of this state.
Yeah. So it's similar in ways to, you know, Scotland obviously has had, you know, voting to, you know, should we leave the UK, mm-hmm. you know, the United Kingdom and be our own independent country and stuff. And on their previous vote, they decided to stay. It was very, very snug on the vote. But, you know, they have a devolved government, in fact, all four nations in the UK to have a devolved government. And they, most particularly with coronavirus, you can see they can manage their own health policies for what they want in their country. So we're doing this. England's doing that. Scotland's doing this. Northern Ireland's doing that. You know, so those are nations within a nation as well. So now I'm thinking about Manetherin being Scotland.
Which, hey, I am all for. I think about Manetherin being Quebec. I think about Manetherin being Scotland. You know, there's lots of instances where this happens.
And now I'm also imagining, like, you know, just send Bowie with a thick Scottish accent. And then his wife walking in with a French accent. And you're like, what's going on here?
Well, that's the roof.
Yep. That's great. I love that. That's someone needs to make you know, some kind of skit with those two doing that.
I think about that a lot. Just, I don't, because I'm, like I said, Quebec nationalism affected me growing up. It was an interesting thing. I'm French Canadian, so it's a thing I think about a lot. So yeah. Anyways, that's my theory about Manetherin. There's other, it's so fascinating with the Wheel of Time, because I don't think Robert Jordan was a nationalism scholar, but there are things that played out. Another one we talked about was Malkier. Mm-hmm. And so a term that gets used a lot is called diaspora. And basically, or diaspora, it's said both ways. I was taught to say it diaspora, but you might hear it said diaspora. I think that's more aligned with the Greek way of saying it, which basically the Greek, it's Greek for dispersion. And so originally it was applied to the Jewish people after, I think, the destruction of the temple in AD 70, when they were kind of dispersed throughout the world. And the Jewish homeland, the idea of diaspora is that they've been dispersed. And so other nations have kind of taken up that terminology. So you'll hear things sometimes about like the Indian diaspora. So all the people from India who moved to Canada would consider themselves part of an Indian diaspora. Or people who've been forcibly removed from their land. So like people from Tibet who've had to flee Tibet would be a Tibetan diaspora. So there's kind of different ways that that's been interpreted. And so the country that kind of most fit this idea of a diaspora in the Wheel of Time to me was Malkir. And just thinking about Malkir as being dispersed. And so Malkir still exists as a nation, but not a state. But they're a nation in diaspora.
Yeah. It's not a term I picked up until I read the book. But as soon as I saw that in your notes, I was like, yeah, that's actually, it made me think, did Robert Jordan, you know, write it in that manner? You know, the story of them thinking, well, you know, here's a nation. And there's not even, you know, not until obviously Lan is riding towards the gap, thanks to Nynaeve from the other end of the Borderlands, and collects thousands and thousands of people in the process, that you actually see the nation of Malkir. Mm-hmm. You know, but they have come from everywhere. You know, she's gone searching for everyone who's wearing the Hodori or has, you know, any links to Malkir, and basically saying, you know, you need to go find my husband because he's riding off to war, you know, and there's even people there that, you know, my father was Malkiri, but I was born in a different borderland and stuff. And they're still like, well, you know, actually I want to ride Malkir. So they want to be part of the nation. And it fits perfectly in the descriptor.
And those intergenerational stories are very true. You know, in Canada, any of us who aren't Indigenous are settlers. And so, you know, most of us know, you know, French Canadian, Scottish Canadian, that's my history. And so I have this weird tie to the history of Scotland that even though I've never lived there, you know, I get weirdly Scottish nationalism, having never lived there. It's very strange. And I think that, you know, that shows up in Malkir. They've never lived there, but those stories, and that's why I like Paul Ricoeur's idea of identity. The identity is tied up so much in the stories of Malkir, and they're pretty powerful stories. It's like they fell to the Blight. They, you know, put the sword in Lan's hand, an oath was sworn over him. All those people fought to get him out. Like, it's a pretty powerful imagery. And, you know, again, Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, we have the Seven Towers of Malkir that have fallen that no one can get to. Yeah. All those same myths and structures that make Malkir a nation are there, but without a state. So,
do we see any other examples of this? I don't think we do, really. I'm just looking through your list of. Shelley has literally gone through pretty much all the nations of Rannan, as far as I can tell, and put down their status, the government notes, important things. I think they are the only example in Wheel of Time.
Yeah, I think they'd be the only diaspora. Mm. It's that homeland that they can't return to. And I don't know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I remember of the last battle, like, they win the last battle, but that doesn't mean that Malkir comes back.
No, I think that the Blight dies. So they, I suppose in theory, could go back and rebuild it. Mm-hmm. So the Blight disappears eventually, and you know, it's not like a light switch, it doesn't just, you know, disappear overnight, but it does die off and disappear. So you could in theory rebuild it, but then what would the purpose of Malkir be after that sort of thing? You'd have to find a new, you know, a new driving force for the nation, because, you know, they were there defending against the Blight.
Yeah, and that's with all the borderlands, there's that other. And sometimes the borderlands in and out, and again, this is nations within nations, the borderlands themselves have a borderlander identity that's very strong in the books. You know, they fight against the Blight, even though like the Saldaeans and the, what's the country with Faldara? Shinarans.
Shinarans, yes.
You know, they'll mock each other and they'll be like, oh, those Saldaeans, oh, they're so weird. Oh, those Shinarans, they're so this and they're so that. But when it comes against the Blight, they're like, we are the Borderlanders. We stand against the Blight.
Yeah, well, that's one of the questions you put in there. Are the Borderlands actually one nation with distinct states? Mm-hmm. Because they do talk about themselves as separate nations until it becomes a discussion about facing the Blight. Mm-hmm. Or, in essence, the rest of Brandland, because they're like, ugh, all the others, they don't know what we do. You know, yeah. They don't really understand, you know, like their direct neighbors in terms of borders will, you know, have an inkling because they'll be trading with them and such and seeing things and hearing things. But, you know, after that, it becomes stories about stories about stories. And, you know, the traders are telling wild tales just to get people interested and, you know, captivated by them. So they'll buy their goods and such. So they do talk about the rest of the continent as, you know, everyone else, the others. I don't know. I think one nation kind of fits until it becomes, and yeah, maybe they're the United Kingdom, four nations together that actually rule themselves separately. Ooh. But until there's one thing to do for the rest of the.
I mean, there was a Scottish king for a long time.
There was, yes. I'm pretty sure there's been a Welsh king, and there's definitely been an Irish king at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's. I don't think he wrote the Borderlands thinking about the United Kingdom, but
you never know.
You never know.
That's the thing with Robert Jordan. You never know. I mean, maybe Mad Hatch does, but
yeah. Yeah. I feel like, you know, Maria and Alan and, Harriet, I feel like they might know, but, you know, but this is the Grey Verdo story. You see things and you recognize, you know, something from your own experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, so here we're talking about four, you know, nations or, you know, four states that are actually a nation really. And, you know, that just made me think about the United Kingdom. So, you know, it's just my own experience coming in there, but, it's a cool thing. I don't know. What do you think, folks? You need to tell us, send us a, you know, a message or something, a tweet or a, something. I'll put a poll. I can put polls on Spotify now.
Oh,
yes. That's I know Spotify's in the news for bad things, but podcasts go there and I can add polls on Spotify. So I might do that if you listen on Spotify.
Well, they took a Canadian national icon off, so.
Ah, yeah. Spotify are not the greatest people.
I have switched to Tidal. I mean, they pay their musicians more and their music quality is better, so.
Ah. I don't use that. I'm firmly entrenched in the Google systems too long. So to be using other things, like I don't like to pay to listen to my music because I purchased the music I want to listen to anyway. So I don't want to pay a service to, you know, listen to random things where I'm totally digressing now. Cut that bit out. But yeah, I'm like, why pay for Spotify to listen to 100,000 songs when I only want to listen to, you know, 20 albums? You know, I'll just buy the 20 albums. But anyway.
The other thing that I thought about too was, the country next to Tyr, Barrelane's country.
Mayen?
Mayen, yes.
Yeah, Mayen, however you want to pronounce it.
Mayen. I wonder if at one time they were like the two rivers. Because when you think about a small nation like that, that's always trying to be absorbed, or always, and a bigger nation is always trying to absorb them. You know, I'm wondering, I wish I knew more about the history there to know why they aren't part of Tyr. Like, was he thinking Portugal to Spain? Was he thinking, Taiwan to China? Like, what was Robert Jordan thinking when he put this tiny, powerful country next to such a big country?
Yeah. So in FY994, upon the death of Hawkwind, the city of Tyr declared independence and claimed all of the lands of the province of Moriana, which included Mayen. Other factions resisted the claim, and during the War of 100 Years, Tyr was too busy fighting for its own survival to worry about its claim to Mayen, and Mayen, for its part, made no claim until 1004.
Yeah. I wish I knew more about European history to know kind of where Robert Jordan was thinking about that. But there you go. That's an example of what, you know, might be happening in the two rivers.
Yeah.
With Andor and, yeah.
It's a precedence for it. I could see future queens of Andor being like, no, you need to be part of us now. Come on, this is what you've always been. And perhaps even because Tyr's tried to, take the city by force and they've gotten defeated.
After the Battle of the Two Rivers, I would put money on the Two Rivers against Andor.
I would too. You know, they were building walls and such. They were going to have like a walled city, basically, or a walled town, which probably would have become a city, let's be honest.
Yeah, and I think a strength, and this is probably my Canadianness coming through, a strength of the Two Rivers is the immigration that happened, I think, because, you know, their population exploded. And an interesting thing about immigrant populations is, you know, when you study them, often the first generation of immigrants can be more nationalist than the actual, you know, pre-existing inhabitants to a place. That's kind of something that they've seen in some research, is the people who get there are like, if we're going to come to Canada, we are going to be Canadian. And they get their own surge of Canadian nationalism. And they still sometimes have it for the countries back home. But, you know, that could happen, that the people who come there are like, well, this is the country that took us in, so we're going to protect it, and then build up on that nationalist ideology.
Wow. So, is that because, you know, they've gone through struggles and trials to get there, and so they need to, I suppose, on a conscious or subconscious level, make sure that it was worth it, and they're firmly there, and they don't have to then go through more trials?
Maybe. I mean, it's a psychology of migration, right? There's lots of studies about it. They're much more broken down now, but, you know, the gross overgeneralization was like the first generation, you know, tries to fit in but never gets fully accepted. The second generation kind of rebels against their parents and they want to fit in more. But then the third generation is like, hey, we want to know more about our history. And so that's when they kind of like go back to thinking about where they came from more. And so it's a gross overgeneralization, doesn't match every immigrant experience by any sense. But what's interesting in Manetherin, one thing that doesn't exist is like, there's no new language. And so there's certain things that would have made the immigration experience there very different than the immigration experience in, you know, our world. You know, the lack of new language to learn. The customs are different, but not always that different. Like whenever you see our Edmondsfield Five traveling around, they notice different customs, but they don't actually ever really have culture shock, as far as I can tell, where they're ever just like, this is the place that's too fucked up. Like,
yeah, they complain about things like, they eat weird meals here, or, you know, like their houses are odd, or they wear weird outfits. But it's not like, I could never be here. And in fact, sometimes they're like, oh, we should actually, like, I'd love to wear that or eat that.
Yeah.
You know?
Chopsticks. These are fun. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Unless you're Nynaeve, I believe. Is it Nynaeve can't use chopsticks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Surprising no one.
But yeah, so as you say, when the immigrants come to the Two Rivers, they don't have to change language. They don't even have to change currency.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, when I went to New Zealand, okay, I wasn't emigrating to New Zealand, but I was there for a number of years. I had to, you know, change currency. You know, I didn't have to change language. They speak English, but, you know, they speak, you know, their own slang version of it in various places. And there's obviously the native culture of the Maori language that, you know, I have slang from that. I can't speak Maori. Not even going to attempt to try and butcher that on the podcast. But, you know, there's slang that I have from that. You know, so that was reasonably easy, but it's going to be super easy for, you know, the people moving to the Two Rivers, because their issues they're having is like, I want to set up a blacksmith, you know, forge. I want to set up, you know, an apothecary, I want to make clothes. I want to, you know, I want to set up a tiling business, you know, things like that. So it's just their businesses and their practices, their trades that they need to fit in, which is going to be a lot easier than trying to learn a new language and a whole new currency. You know, it's just like, how much tax do I pay?
Whole new culture, not having your credentials recognized. Like, a blacksmith in Ranland is a blacksmith is a blacksmith.
Yes.
You know, if you are a nurse in England and move to Canada, you can't practice nursing right away. You have to have your credentials recognized, possibly retrain. Like,
even drive in some other countries with your license.
Yeah.
You know,
there's always these things you have to transfer that, you know. Fortunately, Robert Jordan can wave away, because as I've said before, bureaucracy doesn't make for a great novel. So there's probably reasons he doesn't include that. But
yeah, but we, you know, we'll also not include that, and it makes it very easy. So, But yeah, that would definitely be a big advantage to them in the Two Rivers. You know, all those folks coming over and just being able to emigrate so easily.
Thank you. Yeah, there's definitely a, because I don't want to downplay the fact that they are refugees, a lot of them. So they have been through that kind of experience. And that will be difficult and there will be trauma there. But compared to like immigrant experiences in our world, it's going to be different. But again, they've got that, they took us in. So there's likely to be more nationalism coming through in that group. So.
And put your smart money on the Two Rivers to win, folks.
Yeah.
That was what we were saying there. So
we
did get back there. I want to go through some of your other questions here because we're kind of like dipping into these other the questions for the debate here. So one of them you've put, if Tavalon is an independent city state, is the destiny of the Black Tower to try for that kind of status within Andor? Or is Andor doomed to break up because of the Black Tower and obviously the Menefrin discussion we've just had? Mm-hmm.
That's a good question past me.
It is a great question. I love it. So, I mean, let's talk about Tavalon first. It is very much its own place. Is it a nation?
I think it's definitely a nation and it's definitely a state. And I think I said in the notes, and I think this is a pretty common assumption, is that it's very aligned with the Vatican, right? Like it's a nation state. The religious seat of power is also the political seat of power. All those sorts of things. I think it would make a lot of sense for the Black Tower to kind of want that. Now, my map of the world kind of stinks. Tarvalon is an island, at least, but I don't know what nations are around Tarvalon as an island.
Not many.
Yeah,
I feel like there's just land around it.
Map of Randland.
Yes.
The first map that came up was from a Tor.com article called Why Doesn't Randland Have an Actual Name?
I mean, yeah, that's
a good question.
It is a very good point. The Westlands, I read it, a note from Robert Jordan saying the Westlands is how he wanted it to be known as. He did not like the name Randland, but the fandom likes it and they've rolled with it. So, so Tavalon is, it's not that far south of the Borderlands. It's kind of northwest from Kyrian. And very much, it's a fair distance further away from Andor, and that is to its southwest. So Kyrian's to its southeast. Andor's much further away, I would say probably three times the distance to its southeast. Southwest for Andor. To the west, there is pretty much nothing. You've got the Black Hills and then just open land, Carolane grass, and to its east. And I say this just looking at the map. I'm assuming it's north, south, east, west as you look at the map. It's just Kingslayer's Dagger very, very quickly. And then the obviously the mountains leading into the waste. So there's not a lot around Tavalon. In fact, I suppose they could have a huge space if they wanted to, really.
Yeah, that kind of helped. And it's interesting. They have really good relationships with the nations close to them. So the Borderlands and Andor and Kyrian. But Tyr is much further. And so I wonder the influence of that city being so far from each other. I wonder how much that plays into that. But yeah, I think the Black Tower probably will want what the White Tower has, but is going to have a heck of a hard time getting it. Because, you know, when you look at what's surrounding Andor, Geldeon, Amador, Altara, Saladar, Ilion, Farmadding, Tyr, like there's a lot of countries around Andor that probably don't want an independent city-state.
Yeah, agreed.
So they might get a little more opposition, but again, there's the othering. And we've all seen what those guys can do. So if they decide they want it, I don't know how much there is to stop them from taking it.
Pretty much, I think that only only the White Tower could stop them, really, I think. You know, because they're the only ones that really have the power. And even then, it's going to be a pretty epic fight. And is Andor really going to be wanting that All right, not in their city center, but, you know, in their, right next to their city, like, do they really want that happening? You know, for what in essence is a tiny piece of land they could just, you know, in terms of the actual size of Andor, because I've got up like a highlighted section of Andor, and it's actually a lot larger than you think it is. They could just sort of like cut off that chunk and be like, okay, that's yours, you know, for a bit of peace and quiet.
Yeah, this is interesting because I'm like, okay, so Tyr and Farmadding aren't big on channeling.
They are not.
How much of it would be they're not big on women channeling now that the corruption, I love that the TV show calls it that.
I still think it should be called Taint, but corruption works.
But now that Sidine is cleansed, fuck, I can never remember Sidar and Sidine. This is why binary is stupid. Now that it's cleansed, you know, will they have as big an issue? And will it be that their issue was actually with Tarvalen rather than the channeling? Because, you know, if I were the Black Tower and I were trying to gain independence, Tyr and Farmadding are probably where I'd go first. Because if they hated the White Tower, odds are they'll be very happy to support someone standing against them, especially if Andor and Queen stay aligned with the White Tower.
This is true. Yeah, so they could be getting a lot of help.
Politics brain kicking in.
Yes, this is a good way of thinking. And also, the Black Tower kind of ends on a more of a, you know, we're going to be part of the people as opposed to apart from the people. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the vibe you get from, you know, the direction of the tower from the end of the books. So that would play in a lot more with them. So interesting. Again, folks, if you're listening, what do you think? Like, does the Black Tower need to move house? Are they going to get their own little piece that they need to get allies, so to speak? Interesting.
Will they unify? I don't have a lot of faith in that. I think there's a long time to heal that bad blood. And if Cad Swain's the Amyrlin after.
Yeah, I don't see a Grey Tower.
Yeah, I do. Grey Tower.
Yep, that's what you hear sometimes, isn't it? I did theorize, Jess. Jess from Amyrlin's study. This was before she was Amyrlin's study, but she joined me and we discussed the future of the Black Tower, so to speak. And we thought that they would not want to get involved with the Aes Sedai. They'd want to retain their identity, but they would want to learn about, you know, female channelers and have some sort of, you know, partnership with a group of channelers. And we theorized in the end that they would potentially seek out the Wise Ones, you know, and, you know, do an exchange program of some kind, not entirely sure. And then we were like, perhaps they would end, you know, relocate out to the Waste because the Wise Ones would be more amenable, you know, because the Black Tower would be like, hey, we can help train your guys that can channel because they don't have to run off to the Blight anymore because A, there's no corruption and B, there's no Blight. So, you know, and in essence, you can then give us a safe place to be, you know, and we can work together on things because, you know, they want to be. But, you know, I can't remember the exact details, but that was kind of where we were going. You know, that was kind of where we finished on that. And we were looking for the old term way of saying sandcastle in effect, because there's no real words for, you know, tower or things like that. It's just like tar this or tar that. I can't remember what we called it in the end. I'd have to go back and find the messages with Jess. But yeah, we did speculate then that they would be moving. But, you know, if they stay and get allies with Tyr and Farmadding and places like that, maybe not Farmadding, but, you know, it is possible. Mm-hmm. Could be interesting. What do you, listeners, what do you think? You need to tell us.
Yeah.
So
what's going to happen to all these lands?
So, all right, let's go through this list now. I don't know. So we've already covered like the language thing. Mm-hmm. Nationalism is not as, maybe we leave that one last. Okay. Under the definition of imagined community, the Aiel Sea Folk and the Tinker Nations, like they are nations, but what about states for them? So I think the Aiel kind of have a state, or, you know, the Waste, it's pretty firmly theirs, isn't it? It's got defined borders. You know, mountain ranges can do that for you.
So, yeah, it's kind of a council of chiefs and a council of wise ones is kind of their governing structure.
And they have sort of almost like states within them because each clan has you know, land masses, your space in the waste. Like, this is our land, that's your land type thing. But they're very much, there's the others, the wetlanders.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they fit into that. The sea folk is a bit trickier, mm-hmm. because they're just sailing around all the time.
They do have that island.
They do. Where the Aymar, it's like A-R-R-M-Y or something like that, isn't it? Y-R, I forget the spelling of it.
Seafolk Island, Wheel of Time, Google. Help
yes.
me.
Good old Google. Yeah, but they don't go there very often. Like, they go there when absolutely required. I think they, like, someone takes turns, or certain people take turns, mm-hmm. helping run it for the people that live there. The AR might now be the folk from the other site, Shara. Actually, I might be thinking of the completely wrong people.
No, so according to a very big skim of the Watt fandom, there is Isle Somera and Isle Jafar in the Aerith Ocean. And it is assumed but unconfirmed that the Isle Dashar are also inhabited by the sea folk. And Tremolking. Oh. That was the word I was looking for.
Tremolking, yes. Oh, of course, Tremolking Black, the tea. Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so they do.
Yeah. So you can be a nation without land. That's the whole thing about a diaspora, right? But mm-hmm. they aren't dispersed from a homeland. And so, although if Tremolking is kind of a homeland to them, who knows? Or maybe they consider the ocean their home. And this is the definition of home can change. You know, what's your definition of home? What's your definition of homeland?
This is true. I mean, you know,
or home water in this case.
Yeah, home water. Yes. I mean, you know, well, Moraine says, you know, home is this horse. Home is this brooding man beside me. So, mm-hmm. you know, home is a fluid term to a lot of people. So they could just say that the sea, the ocean is their home.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally they have to set foot on land, and that was Tremolking.
But it's very tied in, like, homeland is very tied in with nationalism, right? Because, you know, home
yes.
is a term that is, you know, tied to stories and invokes those feelings, you know, of connection and nation and comfort and safety. And so where you define home, that's, you know, that's going to tie it to a nation. So I think answering past self, because it was probably 6 months ago I wrote those questions. You know, I'd probably say the Seafolk.
It's great.
I just apparently was possessed by my Scottish grandmother for a moment there. I don't know what happened. Get your own body, Granny. The Seafolk obviously are a nation. Mm-hmm. And I think they're a state. Like, they do have a system of governance.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just
they have the wave mistresses and the clans and a hierarchy system that is very regimented. So
yeah.
Definitely have that.
Yeah. So it's just their definition of homeland is different. It's basically home water.
Yes.
Or maybe Tremolking. But yeah, the sea is definitely their home. So I'm trying to think. Yeah. Again, I can't think of an our world equivalent to that.
Pirates. Not really.
No.
Like cliche pirates, maybe, if that was, mm-hmm. you know, obviously pirates today are extremely different to pirates that we see in movies, which are obviously not historically completely accurate. take extremes. So yeah, I can't think of anything else that would even fit.
Yeah. I almost wonder if that's, well, no, I was thinking about the Wizard of Earthsea series. By Ursula K. Le Guin, but it because they take place on an archipelago, I think
right.
that's how you say that. And so
yes,
it's like thousands of tiny islands that people go between. And part of the story, when you read past the first book, The Wizard of Earthsea, is them finding a king for those islands, because they are a bunch of different. And you know, they find people who do live on rafts, and very rarely, like I think they go to land once every couple years for a ceremony and then basically live on rafts. So maybe he's drawing on other, maybe he's being influenced by that story.
Could be.
Wouldn't surprise me if he read Ursula K. Le Guin. I'm in a reread of her books right now is why I'm thinking of her so much.
Right. I mean, he pulls from everywhere and anywhere. So it's very possible that he read that at some point or heard about it and was like, huh, I could use that. So
let's make these guys but bigger. Because actually, this is the interesting thing. Sea folk in the books are written with dark skin. In Wizard of Earthsea, they are also written with dark skin. So Ged, the main character, is famously dark-skinned because when they made the first movie, Ursula K. Le Guin got really mad because they made him a white kid.
Ah. So, yeah, that's a valid reason to be upset.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe he did draw on them for the Sea Folk. It's possibly a really good series if you've never read it. She's a genius. Like,
I have a long enough TBR already. I just committed to reading Malazan, so...
I'm aware.
At some point. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You're reading it too, Shelley. Yes.
I started the Malazan support group.
Yes, it was your, wasn't it your idea for the Malazan support group?
I don't think it was my idea, but I think we talked about it and I said, I will enact it because I've got it from the library. So I have a limited time to read it.
Ah, yes.
And so I need some support.
Folks, please send your support to Shelley if you're reading Malazan or have read Malazan so that we can make sure that she has all the help she needs, because apparently it's quite a series.
It's off.
I'll let you know when I get there, because I'm going to do I'm considering doing independent podcast episode, but like quote bonus episodes. I've been like, oh, so I've read this much and this is my thoughts so far. You know, we'll see how that goes if I do it. All right, so the Tinkers, you know, very dispersed. But did they have a land originally, thinking about the origin of the Tinkers with the Aiel?
See, if they have a land, this is the interesting thing about their story. It doesn't seem like they're connected to it. Whereas the Aiel have the threefold land that, you know, they are very connected to the land. It's, you know, the iron to shape us, the et cetera, et cetera. The Tinkers don't have that. Their story, do we even know in the books if the Tinkers remember their origin story? I know they're looking for the song.
It's never brought up. Mm-hmm. If they do know about it, it's never brought up. And I get the vibe. Mm-hmm. Others may not get this, but personally I get the vibe that they don't know their origins. Mm. They've always just been wandering people telling their stories and following the way of the leaf.
Interesting. Because by most definitions, they are a nation, but they don't have a homeland. They're definitely an imagined community. Let's look at our checklist.
I believe they even describe themselves as a nation at some point.
They definitely have hostile surroundings.
Yes.
They
memories of battles.
This is why pacifism is so interesting, because it's almost their non-participation in battle that makes them a nation, because that's their tied identity, is that they'll either run from it or, you know, in the case of the Two Rivers, you know, we'll help with the medical stuff, we'll carry away the children, but we're not going to fight. So it's still their role in battle, even if they're not fighting the battle. Like, how they approach battle is more important to them than the battles themselves. I don't know if that makes sense or feels like a weird twist to, if I'm trying to put a square peg in a round hole here.
No, I think there's enough nuance in that to, you know, to make it a valid point. I was picking up what you were putting down. There we
Thank
go.
You.
So high autonomy. They definitely have, you know, it's not as regimented as others, but, you know, they have the Seeker. Mm-hmm. I forget the other position. But, you know, they have people leading the caravans. And they have traditions on what they do when two caravans or three caravans meet up and, you know, what they do together and such, even if it is just a case of, right, now we throw an extra extravagant party. You know, they still have things that they do as part of their culture for that. Sacred centers? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. That one I don't think. Maybe. I mean, maybe the Ogier groves. I don't know. Someone else may remember this more, but I feel like I remember hearing something about Tinkers in the Steadings, but I could be wrong.
Having them mend things for the Ogier does sound right.
Something's hitting me there, but it might not be a sacred center. But I mean, if I was a Tinker, what would be a more sacred center than a peaceful place like a Steading?
Yeah, it's just not, because they're driven to find the song, they just don't stay there. So
yeah.
Languages and scripts?
Not so much.
No, not so much with that one.
But again, that's a weird Randland quirk.
That is, yes. Special customs, most definitely.
Yeah, for sure. Do you know the song?
Indeed. You know, and just say, what is it RM says? Just say this, and I can't remember what they're supposed to say. So I would be terrible if I bumped into Tinkers.
Yeah.
And I think it's
your fires warm my heart as your welcome warms my ears, but I do not know the song.
Yes, that sounds right. Something like that. Yes. Yeah.
Which I think is really lovely.
It's beautiful.
I think the Wheel of Time, I love the greetings. When Loyal says, your name sings in my ears.
Yes.
Like, that's pretty romantic shit. If someone said that to me, I'd be all over them. And I just love, like, it makes my heart sing. I think he says, like, things make his heart sing, or something sings to my heart.
Yes.
I find myself in everyday speech when someone's like, oh, I think I'm going to take up painting. And I'm like, hey, if it sings to your heart, or if it makes your heart sing, I'm sure I sound weird, but it just is like, I think it's very Loyal, poetic.
Yeah. Loyal has a very poetic and very, you know, romantic way of talking and thinking, you know, he's very, you know, he's, just a very romantic character. Doesn't want to be married, but you know, the romance enthralls him, really.
Yeah.
You know, and he is, you know, life just in, you know, he's enthralled by life in a very romantic way.
Romantic more of the art, like the painting, like rather romance than we think of it, like Harlequin novels, romance, like you think of the romantic period.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. That is what I meant. I wasn't being clear about that. Thank you, Shelley.
maybe you were being clear and I was just being redundant.
No, I definitely, it didn't occur to me to clarify that. And I was like, you know what, if I'd listened to what I just said, I would absolutely thought that Rob meant Harlequin. So, historical records and thinking.
Again, we don't know if they know their origin stories.
Yeah, and they don't seem to keep records per se. Mm-hmm. But although we do have like a Rumspringer type thing going on now. So
yeah,
maybe they keep records of who left and who came back. I don't know.
I don't know. But I mean, they do have this narrative about themselves that they are seeking the song. So they have a mythology of a thing that they're always kind of working towards.
Yeah, it's a verbal history as opposed to a written history, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's, you know, that seems to be the goal of the leaders, to remember that that history. So, yeah, it's an unusual one because, as you say, they don't know where they come from. So that I feel that one would come down to a review from peers, to be a yes or no situation.
So I almost wish we'd done this live so we could have people vote in the Discord online.
Indeed. We're so used to doing this live on Thursday nights. It'd be like, oh, I'll just poll chat, you know?
How do we know what to think? Right now. Who's right? How do we decide?
Well, we just need to have folks, you know, send us messages and such.
Yeah.
So, you know, as a reiteration, folks, you can tweet. Shelly's on Twitter now as well, folks. So you can go find Wise One Shelly on Twitter. I will put a link in the show notes if you're not already following, and you can tweet us. You can just tag us. You don't even have to, like, you know, you can just tag us on Twitter and be like, you know, Malky Talks, Wise One Shelly, and we're listening to your episode, and this is what I think of this.
Tinkers
are
nation.
Yes. Exactly. Tinkers are nation. You know, maybe I'll do a poll on Twitter, like, you know, a week after this comes out or something. Mm-hmm. I'll think about it. We'll give it a go. So, but no, I like that. It's a tough one with the Tinkers.
But so, I mean, this is always the issue with definitions, right? Is the exceptions and those at the margins, are those what kind of test your definition? Because, you know, the benefit, we see some sort of inherent benefit to being a nation. You know, we often assume that there's something inherently good about that. And so if we create a definition that can't include a group like the Tinkers, you know, does our definition start falling apart there? And do we need to rethink our definition? Because then, you know, you can start using, in the worst sense of the word, you can start using that as another form of othering and dehumanizing, like, oh, those wanderers, you know, they're very easy to pick on because they don't have a homeland. They don't fight back. Like, this is an interesting thing in academics. And one of the reasons that academia was hard for me is your definitions always fall apart when you think about them too much. And so
yeah,
here we are hitting the limits of our nation definition.
Yeah, and definitions change over time. You know, what was the definition of a nation 50 years ago or 100 years ago? I mean, just in the timeline discussed in the Imagine Communities book, you know, which is in essence, you know, focused on, I would say, about 150 years, you know, with stretches further forward and backward from that sort of main period. You know, the definition seemed to change multiple times over that time period. So, you know, it's you know, it is tough when you examine it. So, you know, I'm not surprised. It would bug me too. All right, let's go through next in our list. What
really
is Jordan trying to say?
Me eating these fake chicken nuggets doesn't show up in your podcast.
It's fine. I can mute it.
But if it does, I apologize. Sorry.
You're fine. Don't worry. If I hear it, I'll just be like, I'll just generate silence at that moment. So, okay, next on the list, what is Jordan trying to say with Far Madding being the openly matriarchal city?
That was a stupid question. I don't know what I was thinking with that one.
Okay, we'll cut that one out completely.
Well, we can play with it for a minute. What was I thinking there? What were you? What was Shelley's brain doing there?
How does matriarchal a matriarchal city tie in to nationalism? Like, where are we going with that?
What was I thinking there? Well, maybe not. Maybe I'm just not.
Maybe you're just throwing things out and seeing what sticks.
That did not stick.
That's fair.
That's all right.
Okay, next on the list. By the way, I just want to run back to Malkir in Dysphoria. Mm-hmm. You know, parallels to Tibet. And your question, is Lan, however you want to pronounce that, folks, is he the Dalai Lama? If the Dalai Lama had a sword. I suppose.
If we gave the Dalai Lama a sword and made him really hot, is he Lan?
Yeah. Would he be a contender for Butt Rock, folks? Yeah. That is the big question. I feel like that's a question we need to answer on a threefold talk at some point. But yeah, just as I was going through, I was like, I want to bring that up because that's great.
He's a pretty good pick. But I mean, he's a leader in exile.
He is.
He, you know, again, this imagined community that he can't go back to, except the dark one kicked him out rather than another country. So
yes,
it's that leader figurehead to kind of wrap around that you don't see in all diasporas. But you see that it's, and maybe because Tibet was an issue when Robert Jordan was writing. So
yeah. I could definitely see parallels to Malkir and, you know, Tibet and the you know, the just the way Lan is about some things. I was like, I don't know, that just feels Tibetan to me, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, the Buddhist philosophy does influence Robert Jordan, the flame in the void, the meditation techniques. I think the difference is the Dalai Lama, you know, is a, feel fairly safe saying he's a known pacifist. Like he's not a fighting, but he still fights for freedom just in different ways. Like, you know, traveling, raising awareness, et cetera, et cetera. So.
And just even something as simple as Lan strikes me, both in the books and the show, as someone immeasurably patient. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's anyone out there who could be more patient than, you know, your average monk. So
well,
I always just see that as well. When every time I come across that, I just think, yeah, Lan is part monk, you know?
Well, and I mean, this is the thing, right? Like, I think people often associate Buddhism in the West, they associate it with peacefulness and, you know, the Dalai Lama. But if you think about it, the samurai were Buddhists. You know, Buddhism has been, there are many Buddhist countries with Buddhist militaries. Like, I don't know, many, maybe that's the wrong word, but there are Buddhist countries with Buddhist militaries. So Buddhism is not necessarily an inherently pacifistic religion. It's a religion that's been adapted to its circumstances where it is. Western Buddhism looks very different than Eastern Buddhism. And so there are warrior Buddhists out there. I mean, we've all seen the Shaolin monks.
Yes.
The samurais, I think they're Zen Buddhists. My religious studies friends are going to yell at me for not remembering all this. So there is Buddhism that...
This is not a religious studies podcast episode, so you're off the hook, Shelley, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So yeah, there is Buddhism that is tied in with battle. So, I mean, if you think of Lan as a samurai...
Oh, and he, yes. Yeah. There we go. Done. Mm-hmm. Easy. Love that one. Mm-hmm. So how I skipped a question here. Is the Two Rivers already an independent nation state?
Yeah, we kind of talked about that.
We did. We dabbled in that. Is there anything to add into that, or have we covered all of that?
I don't think so.
I think we've covered all of that.
Yeah.
So, okay. Nationalism is not always a good thing. It can be xenophobic, isolationist, and exclusionary. Hopefully I got those words right.
You did.
So was RJ saying something by specifically mentioning all the refugees the Two Rivers took in? I don't know about that.
Yeah, was he being political?
It's very possible. Well, I mean, yeah. It did add a political nature to Perrin's life.
Mm-hmm.
A strong political nature to his life, one that he actively tried to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, aside from the fact he married a, for want of a better phrase, princess. You know, it definitely added a huge level of that to his life. I don't think I got exclusionary, except for when they were talking like traits.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel they were excluding the people. They were just like, I'm a Thatcher. I want to exclude the person who does tiling.
Well, I wonder, maybe the Two Rivers is not where we see nationalism brought to a negative level. Because I don't think it's inherently bad, necessarily. Some people do. There are people who think that nations shouldn't exist. Like a lot of people think anarchy is chaos, but anarchy is actually the deconstruction of hierarchies, for the most part, and the deconstruction of kind of large states and more community-based leadership happening that's more communal. And so a lot of people don't think nations should exist and think that they are inherently bad. So I'm trying to think, what do we see any examples in Randland of nationalism that is twisted, that is brought too far? And maybe that's the Shan Chen, where we see it with them having the expansionist. You know, this was, yes. You know, this was Arthur Hawkwind's homeland. This is our land. And again, that's very USSR, uniting, you know, the Russian countries, the USSR countries, and them saying, this is our land. We're coming back for it. You know, we deserve it. They're technically ours already. So that's kind of nationalism brought to a not necessarily like a negative thing when it starts going into expansionism. Maybe between Tyr and Ilion, that rivalry where they kind of hate each other so much, like that is nationalism kind of brought to a negative because,
yep.
You know, they're more alike than they're not alike. There's no reason for them to hate each other like that. And then you see, I think it's Bale Doman and
Julian Sandar, yeah.
Julian Sandar, like they kind of hate each other for no good reason for quite a long time. And it's stupid when you think about it. And that's kind of, they don't hate each other for any other reason except that they belong to different nations. So maybe I answered that question there. It's their own, that's nationalism brought to negative levels, is when you start hating individuals because they aren't part of your nation. Because they're from a nation that's your enemy, that's your other.
Yeah, because Ilion and Tyr will fight alongside each other when there's a common enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as that common enemy disappears, they're like, oh, well, now we need to fight each other again, you know? And you get the same over the Armuf Plain between Taraban and Ardamon, where it's just like this, you know, expanse between them. They're constantly fighting over it. It's, oh, this is ours. No, it's ours. And then, like, I've got this piece, and no, I've got that piece. And, you know, no one ever really gets the whole thing because they can't actually control it.
Mm-hmm.
But they're constantly fighting each other. In that respect, but then, you know, they'll fight alongside each other if needed. And then as soon as that moment has passed, they go back to fighting over the plane again. And it's like, what's the point? You know?
Yeah. So maybe that's a good example of nationalism kind of brought to a negative thing. And maybe even the White Tower, you know, as much as I love the ladies of Tar Valon, it's like, they've kind of cut themselves off from the world, and there's kind of a superiority that they feel, an ability to kind of meddle in each other's affairs in other countries that I'm sure a lot of countries don't appreciate. And for them, it's, you know, they have access to this resource because they are the Aes Sedai. They have access to the one power. Like, they are kind of the center of the religion. So they use that in a way that's not necessarily positive. And, you know, some nations align with it. So, like, Andor and Kyrian are fine with it. But the nations that don't fall in line, there's a lot of tension there. So that might be, I don't know if that's necessarily nationalism. I could be stretching the definition a bit there. But there's definitely something about their, you know, they feel is inherent to them that makes them superior to others.
Yeah. I agree with, I could see where you're going with that. I think I agree with that.
They've tied their religion into their nation. Maybe that's part
yes.
of it.
Yeah. And then it limits your options on the paths you can take for how you're going to do things.
Yeah.
When you do that. So.
Good old religion in the Wheel of Time. One of my
favorite
things.
Okay. Any other things we want to cover that we haven't covered yet?
Just looking at any of the other nations that seemed interesting to me.
I've got to be honest. I thought we would talk, and I don't know why, but pre-reading the book, this is my thoughts. I thought we would talk like about the White Cloaks a bit. Having read the book, I can see why we haven't.
Yeah.
Because they're, you know, it's just not fitting in with
Is the thing, right? So the White Cloaks, I don't think they're a nation. And if I think historically, they're very much like the Knights Templar. They're very much a military force. I don't know much about the Crusades. It's not an area of history I'm super familiar with.
Me either, to be honest.
But I feel like there were more than just Brits. Like, I feel like multiple countries sent soldiers to you know, Jerusalem, Israel, Constantinople, all those places, Istanbul. So I feel like it was that's who they're basing it off of. So inherently, they are not a nation, as they're sent by other nations. They do have a law. They don't consider themselves subject to the laws. They'd almost be a militia, like one of them. Like, they're almost like a militia that. I mean, like, I start comparing them to like ISIS or Boko Haram or any of those militia groups that exist right now of religious extremists that, you know, they start within a nation, but they don't adhere to it.
Yeah.
So I think that's a very clear example in Vranland of something that's not a nation.
I don't know. It was my first thought. Obviously, after writing down, hey, compare the USSR, you know, later I was thinking like, oh, we'd end up talking about the White Cloaks because they're like a little nation of their own, just like honestly being assholes, you know, like hypocritical in so many ways. Like, you know, oh, you know, well, you know, it's like Salem witch trials type thing. Like, you're a witch if you survive, but if you die, you're not a witch. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm screwed either way. Thank you so much. You know, like. Yeah, we'll wring this confession out of you under extreme torture. Was that really a confession? No, it's not. They're just saying what you want to hear. And then it's like, cool, well, you died in the process, so but you know, redeemed your sins. Yeah, just, you know, they're definitely not a nation or a you know, a state or anything. They just, you know, probably were at one point and now they're not. You know, they came from a nation, they just say.
Yeah, so. It was one guy had a bunch of ideas. Like, honestly, they are the Taliban. They're like Boko Haram. They're like ISIS. They're a religious militia is what they are. And I think that's the thing about militias, right? I think they're inherently to be able to fight against a state or without a state necessarily. So it's that's terrifying, you know, when you consider the show, because they've made the White Cloaks much more frightening in the show, frankly, than in the books.
Terrifying.
And so it's going to be interesting to see where they go with that, because that's the other thing. Nations can align themselves with militias, which Amadicia, I think, has done with the White Cloaks.
Yes, they're based in Amadicia. Yeah.
Yeah.
They basically rule Amadicia. The king is almost a puppet to them.
Yeah. So that's not to say that they can't influence nations, and that nations can't say, well, it's easier if we just align with these guys. Like, we see that again, you know.
So here's a fun question that's occurred to me now. And
question after talking about religious extremism.
So the White Cloaks are not, you know, mm-hmm. they don't have a nation sort of thing. They are, as we've just said, like a religious militia. But what if the TV show makes them into more like nationalists, like they have a nation, and it's like a nation of White Cloaks? Amadicia is, you know, not just where the White Cloaks are based and they sort of, you know, tell the king what to do, but they are, that is what Amadicia is. That's, you know, they are White Cloaks. What if the TV show went in that direction? Rather than making them a religious militia, make them more of a country, you know, that just decides that. I mean, them roaming around the countryside would be weird, wouldn't it? Just in random groups being like, hey, you know.
Does it make them more terrifying or less?
I don't know.
Because it makes them more like Spain during the Spanish Inquisition, almost.
Yes, true.
Which, you know, is kind of terrifying in its own right. That goes into Handmaid's Tale type shit, right? When you've got a nation that's like that, a religious militia takes over a nation.
Well, I mean, in the books, they kind of, you know, they're not far off from that, because in essence, they do, like, you know, they control Amadicia. They tell the king what to do, pretty much. Mm-hmm. You know, like in all but, what's the word I'm going for here? You know, in all but name. There we go. Thank you, Shelley. In all but name, they, you know, they run the country. So, you know, what if the TV show amped that up? The only thing I can see from that, having said that now, is, you know, the roving bands that just kind of like wander around and like hide outside of Tavalon and things like that, mm-hmm. you know, like that bumped into Moraine and Lan and,
well, I think
it would just be like,
what happens then is then that state sanctioned violence.
Oh,
right. So then it's once they become the state, then it's a state sanctioned violence. They're officially able to do those things. And it is almost kind of more terrifying, because then it's like,
yeah,
basically what Moraine and Lan and those kids came up against in the show is a blockade. And that's,
yes.
you know, a very state-sanctioned violence thing that we see in the world. So I think that's the terrifying full end of that thought is,
In a way, and it's really, I feel bad saying it, in a way I kind of want them to do that. I kind of want them to be the ones that run Amadicia. So like have it based on the books where they're not actually in charge, like there is a king or something. But the king does, you know, in essence, like the whole country knows, well, you know, we're a White Cloak nation.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, you join the national, you know, you join the army of your country, you know, you want to be of service in Amadicia, they join the White Cloaks and then never leave because, you know, they get brainwashed. That's how I view the White Cloaks anyway.
I mean, A, it would make it more terrifying.
Yes.
And B, I've said before, like, that's the power of fantasy and science fiction, is you take things to an extreme and you use those to kind of question things. Like, you use those to show flaws and structures in our own world that we assume are fine or assume are normal, or, you know, things that are going right now. If you take them to those extremes in a fantasy novel, it gives you a chance to kind of say, hey, that's why people quote Brave New World a lot. And they're like, oh, it's like Brave New World, because it's like taking things to that extreme. So, I mean, I would hate to watch that. But I mean, that's what kind of, I think, fantasy and sci-fi does so well. Back to Ursula K. Le Guin, like, so much of her short stories are her pulling out weird facets of culture and putting them in other cultures and then examining them from an anthropologist perspective and just being like, wait, this is kind of weird. So I kind of like that idea. Terrifying, but I hate it, but I like it.
It is. It is terrifying. But I think it could be a really interesting dynamic on the show to show a country that is, you know, taken over by religious militia.
Yeah. I'm sorry I interrupted you. When Rand does his like piece of the nations at the end, can you imagine if he has to do that with a White Cloak nation?
Oh my god. And then what would Galad do with, you know, because they get invaded by the Chanchen. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they take over Amadeusia and they, you know, disband the White Cloaks in effect, or the ones that, you know, are there. And Galad ends up, you know, being in charge of the ones that get away. Mm-hmm. I very much paraphrase that situation. But if that's what they're like, how does Galad fit into that? And then, you know, what does he do with them? You know, because then they would be a nation that no longer had a state. Like they would be like Malkir, mm-hmm. like the Tinkers, you know, they would be suffering from dysphoria, kinda, you know, in a way.
Are they going to have to make Galad evil in the show?
Yes. Let's just go with that for a second. Like the White Cloaks that we've seen in the show, Galad accepting that level of barbarism. That's going to be an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, they're like going to have to make him basically a religious extremist. Like we're going to see. I mean, my predictions thus far have been terrible across the board. But I mean, if they're making the White Cloaks worse, having Galad fit in with them, we have to see Galad go through a period of extremism, like being radicalized.
Yes,
essentially, or. You know, or he's going to go through some trauma mm-hmm. of some sort. So something in Galad's story is going to change if they're going to keep him in the White Cloaks. There is this part of me that's theorizing that they may merge Galad and Gawain.
Yes, I've seen speculation for that. I've even heard speculation they're just going to cut both boys, but I don't think that. I don't see that.
That's going to whip their ass. Like that's a scene that has to be in the show.
Absolutely, I agree. I think the fandom would, enough of the fandom riots anyway, what they've done, but I feel like even the hardcore fans and the people that, you know, love the show would be like, now you've pissed me off if you don't get that.
But then it's interesting too, because then Galad becomes a king, technically.
Oh, yes, he would. Mm-hmm. And he can't become a king in his own country.
No.
So, wow.
And then Andor's all of a sudden got ties. Familial ties to Amadeusia.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to unpack there.
That family dinner is going to be awkward.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Like, if he joins the White Cloaks in their current state, you know, and his sister is Elaine, like, how does he even, you know, before we consider the White Cloaks literally taking over Amadeusia, like we've speculated, like, just... Galad and Elaine with how the White Cloaks are in the show, like how are they doing anything? How are they like saying hi to each other or like, you know, yeah, it's your birthday, let's have a party. Like, no, you know, turn up and want to slice my throat, brother. So he's like, well, you know, you can't help being an evil witch, you know, so it's like
Thanksgiving. Don't bring the bird. We'll carry that.
God, yeah, don't bring the bird. Valder already ate it. Yes, so interesting end thoughts. I'm curious now about what they do there, but I think if you could make Galad radicalized, well, I mean, because in the books it's kind of like his logic of right and wrong that gets him into the White Cloaks, isn't it?
Yeah, I think
and that is, it's the power of logic, isn't it, that you can justify anything if you really go extreme logic.
Is it logic or it might not be logic, because one of the things that does attract people, and this is my religious studies scholar hat coming on, one of the things that does attract people to more fundamentalist religion is the world is black and white. When the world is black and white, it's very easy to say what is good and evil. Choices are easier to make. You know, it simplifies how you have to live in the world. When you live in a place with gray, things are more difficult. That's why I love The Good Place, right? Because it just shows you how gray everything has become in our world. But that's one of the appeals of a fundamentalist religion, is this is bad. And then thus your choice becomes easy. So I think someone like Galad, it's not necessarily logic. Here's my theory. If they follow us, Rafe, if you're listening, they go through, Galad will already be prone to black and white thinking. Like that's something that we know. And I suspect he's going to go through some sort of trauma. And the White Cloaks will be there to pick him up. And, you know, that black and white thinking, he'll find very comforting after whatever trauma he's gone through. And it's like, these are good, these are bad. And that's kind of the radicalization that happens, I think.
Yeah.
This is my theory. Could be wrong. Probably wrong. I've been wrong about so many other things.
Well, we can be right occasionally. So, you know, why not this time?
Yeah. But I mean, it's so interesting to play that kind of like thought experiment out.
Yeah. Yeah. The, you know, White Cloaks are already more evil in the TV show. So like giving them an entire country that they've taken over is just, you know, kind of fitting and then very terrifying, as we said. So,
but yeah, the implications for the last battle are what really blow my mind is trying to get all the Westlands to sign, you know, that the Dragon's Peace.
That's That's my mind is going. Yeah, there's a lot of cogs turning in that situation. So, but yeah. Anything else on sort of nationalism that you think we could pop in there? I know I've thrown in a couple of random things at the end there.
No, but I love the random things because they make me think it through. Yeah, I think that's it from my notes.
I think we've covered a lot. We've looked at a lot of different. We've talked about a few big things, so like, you know, the Shan Chen, Malkir, Manetherin, but you know, we've dived into some other examples, you know, Tarvalon, Black Tower, you know, the Borderlands, you know, things like that. You know, this is
so it's kind of been just theorizing about what's going to happen.
Yeah,
with these places. I hope people found it interesting. That's my big hope. It felt rambly to me, but.
No, it didn't feel rambly to me. No, you're fine, Shelley. It was not rambly. So don't think that at all. No, I liked it because it gives you a different sort of way of looking at the different cultures and such, because a lot of these you wouldn't have thought about nations. If you like, you know, the nation of Malkir is talked about a lot, you know, Two Rivers becoming its own thing is talked about a lot. But the Shan Chen, it's just like, slaves, horrible. You know, okay. They're fair with their laws a little bit if once you go past the slavery, you know. But then there's other things you didn't consider, like, you know, the Aiel, the Sea Folk, Tinkers, you know, that they're talked about as nations, but like, you know, are they nations in the way that the other places are nations? You know, how does that play into the way they think? Mm-hmm. You know, Mayenne and Tyr and their situation, you know. So, and then obviously the downsides to things, you know, Dalai Lama Lan as well. You know, that's a good thing.
Dalai Lana.
Dalai Lama. Oh, yes. I'm. Yeah. There we go. That makes you know.
It does make
Lanyol Lana.
Lana.
All right, folks. Let us know what you thought about this discussion. Please, if you haven't listened to the pacifism discussion that Shelley and I did, go back. It's episode 28. It came out on the 12th of February last year, which let me look at the release schedule. Basically, it's going to be a year apart. So, one day different, Shelley. So, this episode
like
will come out.
You should hold it off just for the full year. Just for the symmetry.
Release it on Saturday 12th.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it'll come out on Friday 11th.
And then Saturday, and then the next February 12th, we'll talk about something else. Though I'm out of ideas, Rob. You've exhausted my ideas. I have nothing left to say about the Wheel of Time.
I doubt that. I'm sure we'll find something to talk about. But yeah, folks, let us know what you think and of this discussion and that discussion. I loved that discussion. I've really enjoyed this one too. You know, they're both awesome. Shelley, you are so knowledgeable about a lot of things. So don't you say you don't have anything else to say, because I know that's a lie. So. But yeah, hit us up on Twitter. Let us know. We've asked you a few questions, so go back and answer them if you didn't answer them immediately at the time. Let us know, because we're curious on your thoughts. We're used to a live chat doing Threefold Talk, so you know we don't have that feature tonight. Mm-hmm. So
I think, you know, the thing I want to leave with is I hope people approach this discussion with some grace, because I know there was a lot of politics in here, and I think that comes from talking about nationalism. So it's coming from a place of exploration. And if we said anything that offended someone, please talk to us about it. We didn't mean to say anything offensive. We're just trying to explore these ideas. And I think that, again, like I said, the beauty of fantasy is it's a chance to kind of play out these ideas in a place without consequences so we can learn from them and how we interact in the real world. So I hope that people approach this discussion with grace, and feel free to talk to us if we said something that you think was not good, and we'll come back on and apologize and figure out how we could have said it better.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is, you know, it's a space to explore ideas, as you said, and to, you know, to discuss nuances, mm-hmm. because everything has nuances, you know, every, you know, we live in a world that is extremely gray. There's a lot of ways things can be taken, things can be meant, things can be said, you know, so, and this was just exploring those facets, you know, and I've really enjoyed doing it. So, you know, if it's got you thinking, folks, and, you know, you want to chat to us about it, or you're like, hey, I didn't like that, but, you know, I see what you meant. This is how I took it, you know, and you want to chat to us about it. Absolutely. Totally down for that. You know, it's why I do this, because I enjoy talking Wheel of Time, and I don't just want to sit there and be like, this person's good, that person's bad, I don't like this character. You know, I'm absolutely, yeah, we can all except for Mishima. Yeah.
I'll just dislike him.
Oof, yeah, we can absolutely dislike Mishima. That's fine. You know, Shelley, your joke should have won Tam Joke Search Volume 3. I'm just going to say that again. It was my favorite joke of them all, I had to be honest.
That warms my heart.
It made my heart sing when the first time I read it. Nice. So, but yeah, folks, come hit us up, and you can catch Shelley and I most Thursdays. You know, obviously we have lives, but I'm there pretty much every week. I took a week off once, and it all went to hell. So, I'm not sure I'm ready to take a week. I will take a week off at some point. Leave it. Bane and Sheehan can run it, but come see us at 3-4 Talk. You know.
We have fun.
We have a lot of fun. And we have great segments there as well. Ask a Wise One is one of our favorite segments that we do periodically, where Shelley and the other Aiel on the show answer your real life questions in the way that Aiel would answer them, and help you hopefully find a path through whatever situation you're in, you know, that helps you. And it's a beautiful segment. I love it. Some of the questions we've had have been amazing. Some have been just hilarious. I'm sure we had one about where we keep the cereal or something, wasn't it? We had on the first one. Yeah. So you could ask us anything, and you know, you will get the answers. And you could ask them anonymously. You don't have to be like, yeah, I'm so-and-so from this place, unless you choose to do that. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. So come join us on YouTube. That's every Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, 3-fold Talk. And, you know, subscribe while you're there, folks, because, you know, I'm going to have a big party when I get to 1,000 subscribers.
Soon.
And hopefully that's coming up soon, because we're planning stuff to do at it, including a lot of joke stuff. yeah. Thank you so much for joining me again, Shelley. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me again.
Yeah, I look forward to, obviously, 3-fold Talk, but I look forward to next year's podcast discussion, you know, whatever that ends up being.
I'll try to think of something interesting.
We've got a year to figure it out.
We've got a year. And I mean, we've got enough things we love in common. If nothing else, we'll just come on and talk about food.
Yes. Oh yeah. There's bound to be more food in a year's time. Mm-hmm. So I keep meaning to make some of the other things that I've got on my list. Some from the show as well. So, oh yeah. But you'll have to go over and check out my other channels for those folks. So, everything in the description. Follow, like, subscribe, you know, comment, you know, just come and have fun, because we have fun. So, and until next time, folks, may you always find water and shade.